I think we were just talking about being a finalist in a number of schools and relating that to, particularly without a doctorate, and relating that to the experience here, that it gave you a background and allowed you to demonstrate abilities that perhaps would not have been possible in probably more
Absolutely.
traditional ways. I guess I'd like to tackle the problems you foresaw in the university at that time and perhaps just talk about them. Seeing them at the time and how you feel that your administration has worked them out. Maybe the one I think we've already touched to some degree on is the physical problem, the budget problem, and in terms of the deficit became you became aware that it became public that we had not only a cash flow problem but a deficit problem in the fall of 77, just before or just as in as part of Humphrey's resignation and what you saw happening there, and perhaps touching on Earl Brewer's work with the budget, with your
Okay, I
assistance.
think, and I don't want this to sound unfair or unkind to Earl, but Earl Brewer assumed the vice presidency for finance at a point in time when probably no one in their right mind would have wanted to be the vice president for finance of this place. And Earl worked, of course, we all did then, about 7 days a week, 10, 12 hours a day through Thanksgiving, Christmas, whatever. And I think Earl did about as much as he was capable of doing in about a 6 or, well, no, it was almost a year, I guess, 11 months or whatever. I think he did about as much as he was capable of doing and probably resigned at the perfect time. And I want to stress that Earl's decision to resign was Earl's decision. I didn't ask him to, and no one else did. Probably the main reason was his wife didn't want to come up here, had absolutely refused to come up, didn't. He was basically a Southern California type and wanted to get back there. And that plus, I believe he was beginning to get overwhelmed. Earl was not a political type. Earl didn't even take the local paper. He had no interest in staying alert to those kinds of things. So I think he left at the perfect time for the university and perhaps for himself. Because most of the work that Earl did for a year here, and again, I don't want to say this to detract from Earl, but it was just the drudgery of sifting through the monumental piles of garbage that had been accumulating here in terms of blunders, mistakes, misinformation, and so forth, and sorting it out. He also had the ability to present himself as an honest person. I assume he was, not knowing anything to the contrary. But that was very important because if there was one thing the legislature had to see then was somebody in the VP finance spot who was honest and somebody in the presidential spot who was also honest, but in two different kinds of ways. One honest with the dollars of the university in a limited sense as the VP finance, the president, myself, honest in that sense also, but also managerially honest across the board. So I think from the standpoint of types and how and appearance before to the legislature, I think Earl was almost perfectly suited for that year. I think if he had stayed on, he'd have found himself quickly over his head and would have had problems. I don't think the university would have necessarily had problems, but I think Earl would have. That's how I would characterize Earl. Now, in terms of a quick statement on the fiscal situation, going back to what was said earlier, it will be almost impossible for the university to get itself into a another deficit situation of that magnitude across the board. There will be pockets of the potential for pocket deficit spending. As long as your management reports are even a 30-day period delayed. But one must remember that the first management reports that I put together, which were in January of 77, I estimated that they were probably 75 to 50% inaccurate. It was just the nature of the beast then, the feeding in the information from the units, from the budget review units, BRUs, into the computer. The the management report that came out in February was probably stood a chance of being 65% inaccurate, and the one in March 60, and the one in April 58, and so forth, until now we're down to where we're probably about 10% within striking distance of complete accuracy. And that's exactly, incidentally, what the deficit at ACC is, 10% of their total budget. And there will come a point in time where your management turnaround will be so precise, as well as your cutting off in May in terms of the end of the fiscal year, that you'll be, I would say that probably next year, unless something totally untoward occurs, next year or more definitely the following year, the university will probably come in almost on the dime. I come close to be willing to guarantee that. In terms of cash flow, it'll never happen again, because in terms of your management system being capable of operating controls and not being totally effective, your accounting system is not hinged to that same kind of percentage. Our accounting system now is good enough where there's no chance that there could ever be a cash flow problem develop. It just can't happen. The turnaround time now for the money, we just pecked and pecked and pecked away at those accounts receivable. I can remember them getting, I was getting almost weekly reports. It would go from 14 million to 13 and a half to 13 to 12.8 to 12 and so forth. And I think the last one where I stopped getting them, I stopped asking for them about 6 or 7 months ago. I think we had an outstanding accounts receivable of around $4 million, which is about what we should have at any given period of time, particularly in the beginning part of a year. We should have somewhere between $2 and $4 million floating around out there in accounts receivable. So plus $2 and $4 million, $2 to $4 million is not something that we would have any difficulty handling with just our normal cash flow. We could accommodate that by spending general fund money. On the other hand, they're getting much more, and they should, much more precise in Juneau about what they give you in your drawdown. Remember I said earlier, Max Hung used to put together those three-line memos, and they give them the money. Now we have to almost within about an 85 or 90% factor, have to indicate to them exactly what went out and what is needed and justify our drawdown. In other words, if we say to them we want a drawdown of $7 million, we have to show that we have about a $6.5 million need for salaries, for benefits, for paying this, for paying that, and so forth. This we can now do. So, excuse me. So the fiscal and budget problems, I think, are behind us. The management problems, I don't think they're behind us. And I think that there are some things that could go wrong. And I certainly think that the new president is a capable person. I think that he's an honest person. He certainly is a knowledgeable person. But I also look at the facts, and I think that he is, I don't think, I know, he's been an academic officer totally throughout his entire career. A lot of academic types don't like to hear this, but I think that that's a distinctive order of administration. And I think that the broad managerial responsibilities of running an institution of this kind of this structure and complexity go beyond that. That does not mean that academic officers can't be good managers. And I guess that's what I'm betting on. If he's a good manager, that experience, irrespective of that experience, the job will get done. But there's a lot more to it than that. There's the political side, and there's the fiscal side. And then there's the broad managerial side in terms of just good, solid management techniques in running a university, the business related to the legal aspects of a university, the personnel policies aspects of a university, the collective bargaining aspects, the shared governance responsibilities with your assembly and so forth. All of these things go into the big heading of managerial. So I certainly wish this new president the best. I think there's every indication to believe that he could do it, but I'm not totally happy. And I'm not totally happy because, in my judgment, and I'm only saying this because I would like very much to be proven wrong in 2 years when this is all public, in my judgment, the board ended up hiring a president very much unlike the parameters they laid down at their December meeting last year in terms of what kind of a president they were looking for. What I thought I heard was they were more concerned with managerial technique than trappings. And I think they've come off that position. Now, again, that's their prerogative to do, and my term was up in the end of June, and, you know, I can only sit here now and conjecture. But part of what I think I would put under the heading of the management, those management responsibilities, it is not simply a case, it is not as simple a situation as to simply say, well, now we're decentralized and chancellors have more power than they used to. It's a much more involved situation, and each of our units is distinctive. In Juneau, and these are very simplistic statements and responses to a really complex set of affairs, in Juneau, we're in desperate need of a reorganization down there, which can end up being one of the biggest problems at the university this year in terms of the relationship between a reorganization and the collective bargaining process and what the legislature ends up doing with the Public Employees Act in this state. And, you know, it's just a big bubbling pot of soup. Okay, but that's our smallest unit, and it has very serious problems. It also sits down there, excuse the expression, in the seat of government for the state of Alaska, which makes a certain kind of a special arrangement. Okay, Anchorage, here you have a unit that doesn't even have the buildings that it needs, bursting at the seams, both literally and figuratively and emotionally, to become the top campus of the university system. Well, it can't become the top campus of the university system for a long time, no matter how much population you have down there, no matter how much money the legislature, particularly the Anchorage caucus, jams into that campus. Money and population do not a first-rate campus make. What makes a first-rate campus is a sense of tradition and history and qualified staff. And until you get qualified staff developing qualified, highly qualified programs, and until you get very much and deeply steeped in research and advanced study and so forth, you're not going to be a major university center. So what you've got down there is a cart running around pulling some horses. The cart, of course, is filled with legislators who believe if you throw enough money into Anchorage and develop big-time, quote, basketball, unquote, you'll become a major university. Well, that won't work. Fairbanks, very, very serious problems. I don't think, let me say it this way, I think a lot is to be desired in the management of the Fairbanks campus. I think there's a fear that a ripple or a wave will excitate faculty, and that the faculty will turn on the administration, and that'll be the end of the administration. I see the situation here as being either you make some waves on this campus and you perhaps get some faculty upset, or the campus is going to die on its own, because the history and tradition of Alaska is not going to keep the Fairbanks campus alive. Simply on the basis of history and tradition. You need bodies, for one thing. You cannot roam around the state of Alaska talking about the enrollment being very high on this campus. That figure doesn't mean anything right now. First of all, the highest rate of inflation in the United States, I think, is in Fairbanks right now. Obviously, people go to school when they have nothing else to do. And as soon as the economy improves, people are going to leave school and go back to work on pipelines and so forth, as they did the last time around. Or worse yet, the economy isn't going to improve and people are going to leave, period. They're going to be leaving Fairbanks, which is, quite frankly, what they are doing. And so this campus has got to have some big decisions to make. It's going to have to retrench. It's going to have to retrain some people. It's going to have to, I think, entertain some innovative ideas such as trimesters and utilize the summer period to have a full-blown program to get people to come up here and a whole lot of other kinds of things. I don't see them getting done unless there's some changes made on the campus here. In terms of the community college unit, this state hasn't even decided, you know, what its future is with community college. Is it going to be a separate unit away from this university? Is it going to be part of a statewide system? Are they going to put a community college in any place where more than 2,000 people gather? So there are very, very complex issues that do not lend themselves to simple views on how to deal with them. You're not going to press conference away these problems. You're not going to master plan away these problems. The value of a master plan is to at least commit publicly a course of action. But perhaps more important than publicly in terms of the general constituents of the university, it's the legislature. You have to be in a position to say to the legislature, here's the master plan we've adopted. It has these features, and it'll take these dollars to bring us 1 year closer to achieving the goals at the end of these features. And every time the legislature deviates, the board has to come forward strongly and say, we are not going to accomplish these goals and objectives because the legislature has chosen not to support us in this way. And, you know, after enough of that, the legislature will back off. But we need a plan. My goal was to bring forward the first draft of a master plan at the end of my term. That master plan draft is sitting over in Vice President Trombley's office now, and I noticed from some public statements made by now President Barton that he envisions taking that draft and turning it into a master plan by the end of this year. I think that's a little long, but that's his business. If he wants to take a year, he takes a year. But I think that should happen right away. So,
to hit back on the idea of centralization or decentralization, I think that's been one of the themes both of your administration and obviously of the regents. Is there a problem in decentralization that changes that might be reasonable in terms of local campuses are a little bit more difficult to accomplish? Was it more difficult to move, or was it more difficult to get John Lindauer out or removed or encourage his resignation because of decentralization? Or I'm assuming the other problem here is in terms of Dr. Cutler's ability to govern and to work well.
Yes, that's a good question. The more you decentralize, the more the seat of power is taken unto the unit, and hence those kinds of decisions are tough. But they need not be tough, and I don't think they'll be tough here, because once the president gives up the responsibility of being responsible for hiring and firing his chancellors, then you might as well just pack the whole show in and break it up and have a multi-system higher ed animal in Alaska. Lindauer, your question is superb, because Lindauer believed in the nature of your question. He believed that he'd reached a point in Anchorage where he was beyond the control of this central office. When I first went to Lindauer and said, my friend, I am now the president, and you will be fired unless you resign, which is exactly the way it went. Lindauer said to me, you can't fire me. Now, that's a quote. Now, I think, you know, part of that response relates to the fact that Lindauer, I think, was a little unhinged, my opinion. But I think he believed that. And I'll tell you, I had a damnedest time for about 10 days convincing John Lindauer that I had the power to call for his resignation. And I guess John had talked to, you know, lawyers and politicians and whatever else, and finally realized that, yes, I did. So I guess what I'm saying is, and using the example of the Lindauer thing, I'm going to be totally honest. There's been a hell of a lot more talk about decentralization than there has been decentralization. Now, in terms of the situation that began in the first place, there has been a lot of decentralization, you know, let's say from back to President Wood. But on the other hand, a lot of my utterances on decentralization have been designed to convince the legislature that what they thought was a good thing in 76 and 77 under the aegis of decentralization is coming about. But let me tell you what's happening. Your legislature is becoming more, is pushing harder and harder for centralization right now. In other words, control, particularly fiscal control and management control in the broad sense, and so is the board. So the two most important bodies who screamed for decentralization in 74, 5, and 6, and early 77 are the ones that, in my opinion, have come almost complete, a complete reversal back to wanting control. Take the board. You need only go to a public session of the board and sit there and watch them in their deliberations there call upon the president time and time again to exercise maximum control over this and over that, and the shifting of this program and the improvement of that degree and the hiring of this person and that person and the firing and so forth. And so I guess what I'm saying is that this university is in transition yet, and it hasn't yet found that point of balance where what must be decentralized and what must be centralized. And I can tell you now why. Okay, and the reason why is that we are still not fully developed in the sense of our policies, where the board knows from simply looking on page 9, article 8, exactly what the responsibility is of a chancellor as it relates to the president. There's still enough of a vacuum left in terms of policy development for there to be areas where there's concern. Once the policy is totally developed and there are built-in mechanisms for adjusting policy and changing it and recalling it and so forth, and they are now upon us, then these matters will become resolved. Once the legislature knows, for example, that the responsibility of spending on the Anchorage campus rests with the chancellor, and that it is only the responsibility of the statewide office to see that the policies governing that spending are adhered to. Once they come to acknowledge that and understand it, then they will know where the responsibility lies. Right now we're in a period of transition, and even the legislature, who is screaming and bellowing for decentralization and passing up these totally obnoxious bits and pieces of statute designed to decentralize university, once they see the situation, we'll be in a good position. But right now, what it means, what it takes, is for somebody to have a sense of that balance as to just how far you go. So your question, I repeat, is really a good one, because you create a kind of a, and I don't mean this literally, obviously, or too strongly, but you create a kind of a monster in your chancellor when you keep on telling him you're decentralized. Chancellor O'Rourke, Community College, is a perfect example. Chancellor O'Rourke, and I like him. I mean, I appointed him, I have faith in him, but he has a curious way of wanting to exercise whatever degree of authority and control he sees fit from his operation down, but has great difficulty in understanding that the president has authority over him. He sees there to be two layers of administrative technique or philosophy here, where the president should just give him free rein, but then be answerable to the board and to the legislature for his actions. But he, on the other hand, can do as he. So, you know, I've given you bits and pieces and kind of a kaleidoscopic view here, but it's really difficult to deal with, because it's not neat and easy to gather all of these bits and pieces and parts together and put them into some kind of working form. And that's not totally done yet. I believe we're far enough in having it done that it's more than likely irreversible, but it has to, there's much more to be done on that theme. It isn't done, it can't be forgotten and put aside now.
You find that the chancellors tend to take the prerogatives which they enjoy or want to employ for themselves and then pass some of the dirty decisions back?
Absolutely.
I guess the two that I think of, one is the putting of sabbatical leave down below the expected funding level, and two, I believe one of the campuses put debt service as a low priority, which is maybe a great political move for those who don't know what they have to pay it, but exactly. Not very reasonable.
Yes, absolutely. And again, I think the champion of all champions in that game is the Fairbanks campus. I have half in jest, half, referred to the chancellor of this campus as the dump-up artist of the Western world. I get requests. Here I am, not at this point, but here I was, president of a university system, accidentally sitting on the Fairbanks campus, responsible for a $140 million budget, and I get requests from the Fairbanks campus to provide Klaus Nasky with $380 to go on a trip to Hawaii to read a paper sent to me by the chancellor. Well, they are sent to me by the chancellor so that the chancellor can say to Klaus Nasky, Geez, I didn't have the money because there's no travel, but I sent it up to the president, and now he won't give you the money. So if you have an argument, it's with him. Now, that's the epitome of cheap-shotting the president. But you see, I don't succumb to that. I write a, first of all, I put a lot of time in, so I take the time to write a letter to Nasky and say, I don't know why the hell this request came to me in the first place. Your chancellor has the ability to manipulate his funds from one account to the other, and if he wishes to find $380 to send you to Hawaii, he can. And so don't accept any kind of a suggestion which hints that me not making it available to you means it's not available. That happens on this campus weekly. And I would suggest that it's probably going to continue.
You think there's a perception from your point of view that the chancellor may have more support than he may actually in reality have?
No. No. I think that there are a group of probably a dozen people who owe their futures to the chancellor on this campus, and that's probably the extent of support. I could name them. I won't, but I could name them. But I'll tell you this, that is not necessarily the perception that the board has, because these 12 or 14 people who by manipulative techniques can make themselves appear to be many more people, I would refer to you the chancellor's, I'm not going to discuss it here, but the chancellor's convocation of 2 or 3 months ago, when there was a real fear that I might have ended up staying in the presidency. You don't have to be a wizard to recognize on this campus that the chancellor has problems with me. And there are a number of people who felt that my staying on for any extended period of time in the presidency would have meant big trouble for the chancellor. Well, I'm here to tell you that's exactly right. It would have. I would have called for his resignation. No question about it. Now, a handful of people were able to manipulate a convocation and ask the right questions and get the right responses going back and forth and make the right phone calls to give that impression that there's much more support here than there really is. Lindauer had more support in the Anchorage campus, I think, because even in his insane way of managing, people saw in him at least a kind of unfettered, psychotic movement forward on behalf of University of Alaska Anchorage. And so they said, well, you know, you take the bitter and get the sweet. But no, I think I understand your question, and I would say, no, I think there's far less support here than the research thing alone. You know, here we have a chancellor of the Fairbanks campus and his immediate agent, a vice chancellor for research and advanced study. And after you look at the table of organization and those two titles, that's the extent of the relationship. What goes on up in that West Ridge might just as well be another campus. Now, I'm not saying that's good or bad. That's not the issue. The issue is if you're going to pretend, I mean, if you're going to go through the motions of having a certain order of things, then that should be the order of things. And that one we could discuss probably for the next 2 weeks, but enough said.
How would you characterize the relationship you've had with the regents over the period of time? Has it been supportive? Has it been a strong board? Has it been increasing in strength because of the information and the perspective you've been feeding back to it?
Yeah, I guess one of the measures that a president has of the support of his board is how many recommendations he makes and how many are followed by the board. In other words, it's like a president of the country going before the Congress. This board has adopted every recommendation that I made since before I was president, during the two-month period when I was just in charge. They have adopted every recommendation I made but two. One, in retrospect, I think they were absolutely right in not adopting, and the other, I think they were absolutely wrong, and I think we would probably both agree. I'm not going to discuss the particular recommendations. That's not important. But I think in terms of a board that meets about every month and has an agenda numbering from 20 to 50 items, for my recommendations to be consistently followed at that pattern, I think is a very good indicator. I make no mistake about it. Some people have said I'm too honest and candid, but I only have one real detractor on that board, and that's Regent Banfield. I can't stand Regent Banfield, and I would assume she can't stand me either, and that's exactly the way I like it, because that means it's kind of a standoff. I believe something coming very close to supreme pleasure she probably experienced this last 2 months with my passing out and somebody else coming aboard. And that's okay. I mean, I think if you can deal with 11 people and only have a problem with one, I think that's a pretty good... I'm convinced, of course, that she's totally wrong.
How are we doing on time?
You can take another 15 minutes.
Okay.